expand it.
Please be seated. Well, before we begin, we have some students from Sun Prairie Homeschooling Group with us today, and they were here for the first argument. So they are really getting a good showing of what goes on in this court and a variety of different issues. Would you please stand again for us? Thank you very much, and thanks again for coming. As we said, I hope you can stay because Justice Kelly will come down and chat with you after this case is finished, and anybody else that would like to join Justice Kelly and the students is certainly welcome to do so. You may be seated. Thank you. Okay, our second case of the day, Cintas Corp. versus Becker Property, 15 AP 2457. Are you prepared to begin? Please do.
If it please the court, my name is Patrick Silver, and I'm counsel for Becker Property Services, LLC. I note that the court had distributed a document out front that provides an overview of the case, probably for those who care to
Distributed by the court. It is just a document that's distributed by our communications person, who is not a lawyer, just to let anybody that comes in the courtroom have somewhat of an idea of what the case is going to be.
Thank you. I note from the document that one of the main issues presented, and this accurately tracks the briefing, is the enforceability of the choice of law provision that's in the Cintas service contract. And while the choice of law provision may not control, I think it's a good idea to start with that since it seems to be front and center. Now, I brought my magnifying glass from my Oxford English Dictionary Compact Edition because it may be useful for looking at the Cintas contract.
Ouch.
And I mean that.
So you're not starting with the conspicuous. That's just an aside.
It's obvious that the contract provisions at issue are not conspicuous, and I don't think there's really any need to spend any more time on that, but I'm happy to explain further if the court requires.
Well, there really isn't any requirement that I'm aware of that it has to be, quote, conspicuous, correct?
The requirement is that the liability shifting provision has to be conspicuous if it's to have effect under Wisconsin law, Your
Honor. What Wisconsin law says that?
That is in a series of cases going back to Spivey versus Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company. It's in the McGee case. It's in a number of string sites that are referenced in the briefing.
At the outset, can I just clarify one thing? The Uniform Commercial Code, you are not relying on that in this argument, right?
We're only relying on Section 401. Sub 10, that sets forth the specific definition of what constitutes a conspicuous term.
Does that apply to this kind of contract?
I think it most certainly does. And the reason is because in the Dominski versus Arlington case, this Supreme Court set down a bright line rule, which says, in effect, that any liability-shifting indemnity provision in a contract must be conspicuous.
But that case involved a contract for goods. The Uniform
Right.
Commercial Code applied. There was no dispute in that case. The Uniform Commercial Code does not apply to a service contract. That's black-letter law. So are you just using the definition in the statute to inform the court's understanding of what it means to be conspicuous, but you're not, in fact, relying on it, are you, because this is a service contract?
I'm relying on the statute for purposes of both informing the court, and it's my position that the Dominski case is a bright-line rule that applies without respect to whether the contract issue is for services or for products. There's nothing in Dominski which specifically says that the conspicuousness requirement only applies to a product.
But, counsel, they were applying the Uniform Commercial Code, as rightly so, in a case involving a contract for goods. We do not have a contract for goods here, right?
That is correct. It's a service contract, although the contract does refer to goods and services being provided by...
Let me ask one more time. Are you asking that we apply the Uniform Commercial Code to a contract for services?
No.
Okay.
What I'm asking is that the court apply the law under Dominski, which requires that in liability shifting indemnification provisions be conspicuous, and that the conspicuousness test is set forth by reference to the definition of conspicuousness in the commercial code.
Is this what you're relying on in paragraph 28 of Dominski and the reference to the commercial code? It says, because indemnity contracts in which parties agree to indemnify the indemnitee for the indemnitee's own negligence are, like exculpatory contracts, to be strictly construed, we now hold that the conspicuousness standard in 401.20.10, which is, of course, the commercial code, that standard are required for indemnity contracts. Is that the language, the holding that you're relying on?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, but wouldn't that holding only be appropriate if you were using it for a contract for goods?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Okay. And the reason we are spending too much time on that issue. I don't think you're making
this is a very important point. So I believe it is worth spending time on, because there is nothing in the Dominski case which specifically says that the
question couldn't have come up. Was Dominski involving a contract for services, counsel?
No, ma'am.
It was a contract for goods, right?
Yes.
So the UCC, of course, could be raised, right?
Correct.
But you don't have a contract for goods, right?
That's correct.
Okay. That's, all right. I think, enough said.
So I want to know, so if all of that is true, why do you say Dominski is applicable?
Well, number one, because the issue of conspicuousness came up not specifically because it was a contract for a product, but because there was a liability shifting provision in the contract for a product. Now, the existence of a liability shifting provision doesn't necessarily depend on whether a contract is primarily for a good or for a service. These kinds of liability shifting provisions are generally secondary to the principal and primary aim of a contract. The issue of the conspicuousness came up because under Wisconsin law, liability shifting provisions are deemed appropriate for strict scrutiny because there are serious public policy issues involved. This goes back through a long line of cases. As counsel
for... the provision you're talking about is paragraph 10, right?
Paragraph 10 in the...
In the contract.
Cintas contract,
right,
correct.
Right. And below that is paragraph 11.
That's correct.
That requires your client to purchase insurance to cover any negligence that occurs, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so not only is the liability shifted to your client, but your client is obligated to provide insurance to cover any such mishap, correct?
Whether the insurance would cover it is another question. But, yeah, there is an insurance procurement provision.
Yes.
There is also an insurance procurement provision of sorts on the very first page of this contract.
Right.
And there we find the primary reason why, at the outset, the effect of the indemnity provision is ambiguous. Strict construction or no strict construction. A consumer entering into this contract notes on the very first page that all work will be performed according to NFPA, state, city, fire department requirements, and is guaranteed insured and done by licensed personnel. So Cintas is telling the buyer that the work is insured. Now, there is another provision in the back of the contract, and again, in exceedingly inconspicuous language, which talks about insurance. But it's unclear which insurance is intended to apply to which party's conduct. The first page suggests that Cintas promises that it will obtain insurance, and the reasonable inference is that the insurance it obtains is for purposes of covering Cintas for liability arising out of its own conduct. That's a very reasonable construction of the insurance language on the first page.
Couldn't Cintas be required to provide two different kinds of insurance?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't catch
that. Couldn't Cintas be required to provide two different kinds of insurance under a contract? So even if I buy your argument, I'm not quite clear how that affects paragraph 11.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, Cintas can require or not require anything that they want. They could include language in their contract sort of specifying in greater detail what insurance is required, who's supposed to procure it, what it's designed to protect, and so on. This contract doesn't do that. Instead, the contract holds Cintas out as a professional in the field. It's a contract that Cintas drafted. It has on its front page this statement that the work to be performed is going to be guaranteed and insured, and then 9 pages later is an inconspicuous insurance provision which purports to require the customer, Becker, to procure and maintain insurance. I think it's reasonable to construe the insurance procurement requirement at the back of the contract as applicable to liability that Becker would have for its own conduct. Otherwise, the insurance requirement on the first page is superfluous. In addition to that,
it may apply to something else, counsel, also. It could apply to something else. It could be read a number. You're talking about the one-sentence statement on the first page where it says scope of work and price. Is that what you're talking about, that sentence at the very bottom?
I'm talking about, yes, the italicized, bolded language, all work performed. That's what I'm talking about.
Okay.
All work performed is insured. I'm not sure what insurance would be at issue there, if not insurance to protect Cintas for liability arising out of its own conduct. That is certainly a reasonable construction. I mean, it would be patently unreasonable to say that this clause does not invite the understanding that the insurance is to protect Cintas from its own conduct.
Why would you think there would be an insurance provision requiring your client to buy insurance right below a paragraph that requires your client to be liable for Cintas's negligence? Why do you suppose they might be together?
First of all, the indemnity provision doesn't say anything about negligence or about Becker being responsible for Cintas's conduct. It merely talks about a general assumption of liability under the contract. That is exactly the problem that exists in these inconspicuous contract provisions, and it's why liability shifting provisions, or provisions that have the appearance of shifting liability, why they are subject to strict scrutiny.
Counsel, is it that it's inconspicuous or that it's ambiguous that's the problem?
It's both. Even if this insurance provision in the back was not inconspicuous, it would still give rise to ambiguity.
Okay. So everything in the terms and conditions are inconspicuous, right?
I absolutely believe that everything in the terms and conditions is inconspicuous. In fairness to Cintas, there could be an argument that this bolded language, the capital language in the limited warranty provision may not be inconspicuous within the
contract. Let's say it's all inconspicuous.
Okay.
Is Becker released from any of the provisions in those terms and conditions because they're all inconspicuous?
If they're inconspicuous, to the extent they run afoul of public policy, then I think the law requires that the provision be given no effect as to Becker.
All right. So I want to turn back then to that public policy question. So you were, we discussed Domensky. Let's set that one aside for a moment. Are there any other cases from this court requiring that shifting of liability be conspicuous?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe Domensky is the first and principal case that specifically says that conspicuousness is required for liability shifting indemnity clauses. Now, strict construction is required here because we need to determine what the intent of the parties is at the time of contracting. Now, intent can be shown by a specific and express statement in the contract, but that doesn't exist, and Cintas, to its credit, acknowledges that. Rather, the intent can also be shown if it is clear, and I stress clear, that the purpose and unmistakable intent of the parties into entering it into the contract and including the indemnity liability shifting provision is for no other reason other than to cover the losses occasioned by Cintas's own conduct. So it's our position that the contract is ambiguous on this point minimally, regardless of the lack of conspicuousness. And minimally, it certainly isn't clear in light of the language on the first page that the purpose and unmistakable intent of the parties was that Becker would step forward and effectively indemnify Cintas for any liability that arises out of the work that is supposed to be performed under the contract. Now, there's an important point here to remember. There's not only an insurance requirement stated on the front page, but also the front page of the contract says that the work is guaranteed. Well, what is the guarantee here? I can't find it. The only way that the guarantee could be meaningful, taking Cintas's position, would be if the guarantee provided some protection to Becker in the event of a loss or damage. But it's Cintas's position that Becker has to pay for that. So let me restate that. The work is promised to be performed and to be guaranteed. Now, a guarantee means something more than the promise to perform the work. If that's all that was called for, you wouldn't need the guarantee. You would just say, we agree to perform the work. But this says we agree to perform the work and we guarantee it. What is a guarantee? A guarantee is a promise to provide something in the form of security in the event the performance is not carried out. If you take Cintas's construction of the indemnity provision at face value, there can never be any kind of security for the failure to perform the work.
What about 9 in the contract regarding claims?
Let's turn to provision 9. That pertains to claims for defective goods or negligent service, and it simply sets out a 30-day time period from the date of the service to make a claim. Under the facts of this case...
Well, doesn't it say what the seller then has to do?
Well, yeah, the
there
seller has to either... Sorry?
There are then limits on the guarantee, aren't there?
It says that the seller has to, first of all, has a remedy, and the remedy is that the seller be allowed to investigate, to replace any defective goods, or to credit or refund the purchase price paid. Well, the buyer would get that regardless of any language in a contract.
I remember as a lawyer in private practice litigating claims where someone was seeking consequential or incidental damages, and the provision of the contract limited the liability of the seller so that they weren't responsible for those kinds of things. That seems to be what that claims provision does. This isn't a guarantee that no matter what you claim, we will cover it.
Well, that begs the question, Your Honor, of what is the guarantee? If the guarantee is only you can make a claim, but it has to be within 30 days, that doesn't give you anything that you don't already have under the common law. The common law.
Seller won't be liable for incidental, consequential, indirect, special, exemplary, punitive damages, not liable for claims in excess of the purchase price. Some of that makes sense sometimes, because when people contract, if they're contracting for a certain kind of remedy, the contract price is X. If they're contracting for the remedy to be anything in the world that could be conjured up, then the contract price would be very different, right?
That's plausible, but it merely begs the question of what is being guaranteed here. The way that you've constructed this particular provision, the claims provision, it operates as a restriction on the buyer, and we're still left with the question, what exactly is being guaranteed?
But, counsel, paragraph 8 disclaims all warranties. What do you make of that provision?
Well, this is a provision that is directed primarily to goods that are sold by Cintas. There is passing reference to services, but the operative statement is that the seller warrants that title to all goods sold by seller shall be good and marketable.
Right. It's saying that is the only warranty it's making. It then provides, in all capital letters, there are no other warranties expressed or implied.
Okay. So now you've got a guarantee on page 1 and, in effect, language that says no guarantees on the second to last page of the document.
Did Becker have any obligation to read the contract it signed?
Under Wisconsin law, the party who enters into a contract has an obligation to read it. I believe that's a fairly uncontroversial statement of the law.
Did it have any obligation to discuss these, as you're characterizing them, apparently contradictory terms and clarify what it was getting and make sure that the contract said what Becker thought it was getting?
Did it have an obligation? I don't know, Your Honor. I understand you're asking it from a kind of a common sense point of view. Legally, I don't know if they have any obligation to negotiate. But, this is very simple. There are numerous cases in Wisconsin dealing with exculpatory clauses, which are prohibited under public policy. In none of those cases does the court declare that because the customer didn't read the exculpatory provision that somehow the other side is discharged or that the other side can benefit from that. So the fact that the party is on notice of the terms of a contract or may have some obligation to read a contract, that does not operate as an escape hatch.
Well, they're not only on notice, this is what they agreed to, is it not? And we're not dealing with a consumer, an individual, an unsophisticated party. We're dealing with two businesses who have the opportunity, there's no contention in the record otherwise, the opportunity to read, hire an attorney if they so wished, and negotiate the terms and conditions applicable to the provision of these services.
That the same thing can be said of any contract, including buying a quart of milk at a convenience store.
Well, we're not talking about that. We're talking about a contract for services between two businesses. And I guess what I'm hearing, and correct me if I'm misunderstanding your argument, but I think you're asking us to apply a public policy that says that even a business entity can get out of a contract that it had the opportunity to read and negotiate and hire an attorney to read and negotiate, that they can get out of it. Is that what you're asking us to say because the type is too small?
Everything up until the last comment, but because the type is too small and for also reasons of ambiguity. But again, the same thing could be said of the parties in Dominski versus Arlington Plastics Machinery. Many of the cases that deal with public policy and the enforceability of liability shifting provisions deal with big businesses, including the AMP, including Arlington Plastics and Machinery, including construction companies in the Makula case, The fact that you're a business, an LLC, or just a citizen consumer doesn't change the legal effect of the rule in Wisconsin.
Counsel, you mentioned again Dominski, and I go to the holding and its reference to just like exculpatory contracts. Exculpatory contracts in Wisconsin, of course, are strictly construed, and there's a requirement that it be conspicuous. Are you able to cite to me any exculpatory contract that is based, any case involving an exculpatory contract that differs in its legal conclusion based on whether it's a contract for goods or a contract for services?
Good question. I'm not aware of any. And I'll be perfectly candid. I mean, I didn't review the 13 or 17 exculpatory provision cases that have been laid down by the Supreme Court in the last 25 or 30 years, but they all concern things like somebody who buys a ticket to a ski slope. That's probably a service. They also concern members of fitness clubs who trip on a drain in the shower. So I think that these exculpatory provision cases go to both products or contracts for products as well as contracts for services. I see that my time is just about up. Unless there's further questions, I don't see any reason why we shouldn't allow the good people from Cintas an opportunity to address the court.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Lars Gilbronson, and I'm here with Jeff Davis, and together we represent Cintas Corporation number 2. This court should affirm the Court of Appeals decision for two independent reasons. First, as the Court of Appeals held, the indemnification clause unmistakably and clearly states the party's intention to allocate the risk of the failure of the sprinkler system to Becker's insurer, even if that failure is caused by Cintas' own negligence. Second, this court should affirm the Court of Appeals decision because the contract chooses Ohio law. The indemnification agreement is not prohibited by Wisconsin law and is therefore not afoul of a strong public policy of Wisconsin that would overwrite an otherwise enforceable choice of law provision. And Ohio law would enforce this indemnification agreement to include Cintas' own negligence. I think it might be helpful to start a little bit, based on counsel's argument, with a discussion of what this contract is and what it is not.
Counsel, perhaps I could focus your comments a little bit. How about we start with the first page of the contract, where it says all work performed will be according to NFPA, state and city fire department requirements, and is guaranteed, insured, and done by licensed personnel. And I note that it appears in bold, italicized type, and it is in larger type than the text immediately preceding it. Can you tell me to what insurance that refers?
Your Honor, my impression is that that refers to workers' comp insurance. And let me just say, I don't think that represents an actual term of the agreement. That's not the same as the terms on the last two pages of the agreement.
Well, it's certainly not the same, but what I want to know, though, is why is that not a term of the agreement?
It's more of a general description of the services, and I say that because the services here provided were very narrow in scope. It was an NFPA inspection that's required by the ordinances of West Allis. Mm-hmm. And what Cintas is saying on the first page of that contract is we have NFPA licensed personnel who are going to come out and do this very cursory inspection. I say very cursory, but it's a specific inspection that follows a promulgated checklist.
Yeah, let me stop you there.
Okay.
So that's not all that that statement said. It also said that the work is insured.
And they were insured.
Okay, and the work was insured. So what insurance insured the work?
Cintas had policies of insurance, including workers' comp insurance, to cover its employees, I think.
Okay. But what insurance policy did Cintas have that covers the work?
I don't think there's a distinction of what that work is in the contract, and I think that that's just a general statement that our workers are insured.
Well, it's... Pardon me for noticing, though, that's not what it says. It says all work performed, dot, 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 is guaranteed and insured. All work performed is insured.
And I agree that that language is not specifically defined. I think the insurance they're referring to is workers' compensation insurance.
Okay. And does workers' compensation insurance insure the work or the worker?
Well, it insures the worker doing the work.
Okay. So what insurance policy insured the work?
I don't think there was any insurance policy in this case that expected to cover the work in terms of I should take that back. Cintas did have an insurance. They had insurance, and, you know, they're a major multinational company. There are remedies in this contract. If the remedies require them to return the monies that were paid because the service wasn't adequate, according to the customer, or because, for instance, a part they installed failed, they would make good on that promise, and they would be able to return that money in part because they're insured.
Okay, so the follow-on question then perhaps obviously is, how clear does the liability shifting language need to be enforceable?
The liability shifting language, like the language in paragraph 10, to be enforceable, needs to clearly state the intention of the parties that the liability for whatever the damages are at issue are shifted to the indemnitor.
So now, would you agree that it's possible for a normal reader of the English language to look at the first page of the document and see a representation that your work is insured, to have some inconsistency with the liability shifting provision in the terms and conditions in the penultimate page of the contract?
I think it's possible to find an inconsistency if you read them in a vacuum, if you separate them out. But I think if you read the entire contract and see that what's being contracted for here is a very limited service and at a limited price, and as a result of that, there's a limited warranty provided, and that the intention is that if a third party sues because of a failure of the fire sprinkler system, Cintas is not going to be liable for that liability, that liability is shifted.
So is it your position then that the language in the liability shifting provision in the boilerplate, that supersedes the statement on the first page of the contract?
I think they're referring to two different things, and I'll concede that I don't think the language on the first page of the contract is defined or well explained, but I think that what it refers to are the obligations that Cintas is making under the contract, not the obligations that it's not making.
Does the use of a word guarantee suggest that Cintas was in fact making some kind of warranty?
The guarantee portion, I think, and if you turn to a few pages into the contract, I guess I have page 25 of our appendix, the guarantee is explicitly limited. The guarantee, where the description of services is described there, says this guarantee does not say that your fire suppression system is going to work as intended or that it's not going to fail in the future. It's an inspection to comply with the ordinance and comply with the NFPA. So you go through this checklist and you say things like, are the sprinkler heads covered? What's the pressure in the sprinkler system? It's not a full diagnostic evaluation of a fire suppression system, and page 25 of our appendix makes that very clear. And I think when you read that, which really defines the guarantee, in conjunction with the limited warranty provided and the limited liability, as well as the liability shifting agreement, the contract is not ambiguous.
No, I think if you look at paragraph 9, any claim that Becker makes has to run through paragraph 9. And essentially it says if Cintas does something wrong, you get your money back.
Right. Yes.
And that's the limit of what you're on the hook for, according to paragraph 9.
Exactly. And that's what I'm talking about in terms of the limitation of the warranty, the limitation of the liability that Syntys is taking on here. And part of the reason for that is because this review of the fire suppression system does not allow them to take on the entire risk of any part of the fire suppression system at some point failing. That would be impractical for them because they're only on site 4 times a year. It would be impossible for them to underwrite the risk because they don't know what's inside the building. And it would be inefficient generally because they would have to charge much more money if any time a fire suppression system failed, the owner of the property could turn around and sue Syntys because they said essentially by inspecting our fire suppression system pursuant to NFPA 25, you're on the hook for any resulting damage from a failure of that system. I want to talk briefly about conspicuity or conspicuousness, depending on the way your honors would like to say it, because it did come up here, and we argued that conspicuity is not properly before this court. And I want to reiterate that argument. It wasn't raised in the trial court, and I think it's important for a reason. And it's important because when Becker's counsel argues that this font is actually 4.5 font, I think you can look at the actual copies in the appendix and appreciate that that's not the case. There are 3 different reproductions of the agreement in the appendix. None of these copies were one for one sized. And if you look at them, each of them has a Bates label or some other label at the bottom. Every time that's done, the size of the font has been shrunk down. If we knew in the trial court that an issue was, and that Becker was going to raise the issue, that this contract is somehow invalid because the size of your font is too small and this wasn't legible or something like that, we certainly would have actually had the contract in front of that court, and we would have discussed that in court. And that didn't happen. And so I think sometimes, you know, failing to raise an issue below is important to the appeal, even on a summary judgment motion, as we have here. I want to turn to the Ohio choice of law. And I think the reason I'll turn to that before Wisconsin law, I think it's a somewhat easier analysis. I think we can pretty readily dispatch with the question of whether Ohio would enforce this indemnification language in favor of Syntys, and the answer is yes. If you read the cases that we cite, including the Coulter case especially, which sort of surveys the case, including the Supreme Court case that we also cite, which is the Glasspell case, Ohio does not narrowly construe indemnification agreements between commercial entities. It also construes broad language that contains language such as, you will indemnify me for all claims, broadly to include indemnity negligence. Now, the question I think that this court can clarify and that the trial court was hung up on is, how do we decide, as in trial courts in the state of Wisconsin, whether a particular law rises to such a level of strong public policy that it allows a trial court to rewrite a contract and negate a choice of law provision? And I think if you look at the cases, starting with Bush, what the courts are really saying is, in Wisconsin, we're not going to enforce a contract that's forbidden in Wisconsin. So in Bush, we're not going to allow you to opt out of the Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law because you choose Minnesota law. A Wisconsin court is not going to enforce that agreement that would otherwise be unenforceable in Wisconsin. And the same thing is true in Biofis and the cases cited by Bush. These are dealing not with what Hastreiter describes here in terms of how we look at these indemnification agreements, which is really just a rule of construction. It's looking at rules of prohibition. So are we going to allow a court to enforce a contract that you really couldn't enter into in Wisconsin? And that's when we get to the strong public policy argument.
here.
This agreement is enforceable under Wisconsin law. We're just quibbling about the language. Should it have been phrased differently? And that rule of construction does not, it cannot, rise to the level of an important public policy that the court could overwrite a choice of law provision, because if it could, if that was enough, there would be no choice of law provision that would ever be enforceable. And choice of law provisions provide value, and this is a poster child case for that. Census is headquartered in Ohio. It provides fairly inexpensive services across the country. It's able to save money by providing the efficiency of standardizing its contracts, not having to hire lawyers in every state in the country, and expecting that language that's enforceable in Ohio would be enforced in Wisconsin, provided this isn't some agreement that Wisconsin wouldn't enforce to begin with. Now, the second independent reason that I think the court should affirm the Court of Appeals decision is that this language is clear under Wisconsin law. It meets the Spivey test. And I think this case is also a good opportunity for this court to maybe clarify the Spivey test a little bit. It's not the clearest definition of when we look at an indemnification agreement that confers indemnity negligence and find it enforceable. I think if you read Spivey and you actually read the test, Wisconsin does not require an express statement. And by express statement, I mean magic language. Wisconsin doesn't hold that you need to say, I indemnify you for your own negligence in order that to apply. What Spivey says is, you look at the language, if the clear intent of the parties is that the indemnity is going to be indemnified for its own negligence, then that's enforceable. If it's not clear, you look to other things. And here, the language meets that first definition, or that first test, the first prong of the test. The language says that Becker will indemnify Syntus for any claim, charge, liability, or damage arising out of any goods or services provided by Syntus. That would seem clear enough on its face. That would cover negligence. But the next phrase is really the phrase that I think is inescapable and can be read no other way other than to indemnify Syntus for its negligence. And that phrase says, including any failure of the goods or services to function as intended. It's hard to imagine any failure of the services to function as intended that would not encapsulate Syntus's own negligence. And then finally, the very indemnification language anticipates the damages that we're talking about here today. And that is, it says that Becker acknowledges that Syntus shall have no liability or responsibility for any loss or damage to persons or property resulting from any fire or equipment malfunction. Although this clause doesn't have magic language, it's hard to think of a more clear and specific law clause shifting liability and allocating the risk of loss to Becker, considering the case that's at issue here.
Counsel, one thing I don't understand. When you were answering the Chief Justice's question about paragraph 9, it seemed to me that you were in agreement with her, and your response to her at one point was, well, the meaning of that is if Syntus does something wrong, you get your money back in regard to making sure that the systems are up to the different standards that you articulated.
Mm-hmm.
But then it was a little jarring when you were reciting the language, including any failure of the goods or services to function as they should.
Mm-hmm.
And so that seems to me to encompass a negligent inspection or no inspection at all. You see what I mean?
I do. I know exactly what you mean.
Can you resolve that apparent seeming conflict for me.
Paragraph 9 is the remedy to Becker. That's Becker's remedy.
Yes.
Becker says, Sintas, I followed you around. I don't think you inspected all this. I want my money back.
Right.
Paragraph 10 is what happens when you have a situation like here, a third-party claim. That's what's anticipated for indemnification. So the contract is set up so that it could be enforceable. Typically, Sintas is going to be contracting with one of two people, somebody like Becker, but probably even more often it's going to be with a building. So you have all this limitation of liability and limitation of warranty language explaining we're providing this narrow service, we're not going to be on the hook for insuring your whole fire suppression system. But that paragraph 10, to make that whole scheme actually work when you're contracting with a building manager rather than the owner, paragraph 10 is there to protect against third-party liability.
I don't have that document directly in front of me. Is that, are those different paragraphs delineated in the way that you just recited, remedy and indemnification, so
yes.
that the reader could, I can look, we can, I can certainly look it up later, but that would certainly be a little more persuasive than you just sort of giving me your personal interpretation of.
Well, and there, I would say my personal interpretation is a little more in depth than that, but I think reading the contract, paragraph 9 is titled claims, and I up until then.
I'm sorry, what was that?
It's titled claims,
all right.
And paragraph 10 is titled indemnity.
Okay.
So I read that to apply to claims by the party with whom Sintas is contracting an indemnity to apply to third-party claims. Like
that answers my question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Counsel, earlier when you touched upon what I will call the conspicuousness issue and whether or not it was waived, I had an opportunity to review in preparation for this case the brief filed the surreply brief in opposition to Sintas Corporation's motion for summary judgment filed by Becker. And I see the conspicuousness being referenced several times. And so, it's referenced, two times on page 4. It's referenced and argued about how bold and italicized it is on the front page, and page 6 it says that is having read the conspicuous front page guarantee a reasonable person would not understand that the inconspicuous and equivocal indemnification and insurance clauses on page 10. It goes on further on page 6 to talk about that. On page 7 it talks about the bold and italicized conspicuous print, whereas the indemnification and insurance clause appeared in fine print on page 8. So what's wrong with that? It seems to me that they've raised the issue there. What am I missing?
I
see it several times.
I agree. They raised the small print, and they talked about the small print in the trial court, but they didn't articulate a legal theory of why that matters. They didn't cite Dominski, for instance. That's new to us in the Court of Appeals, the question of whether Dominski means that the UCC definition of conspicuousness applies to all indemnity contracts.
Counsel, would you agree the Court of Appeals kind of got confused, perhaps, about the differences between unconscionability and conspicuousness? They really merged the concepts, didn't they?
I think that they merged the concepts, and in going back and reviewing the appellate briefing, I think to a certain extent Becker merged the concepts too. Becker certainly enters into the conspicuity arena, so to speak, or conspicuousness arena, by first starting with unconscionability. So I think the two arguments were sort of jumbled at the Court of Appeals, but I agree the Court of Appeals put them together. I also want to point out that I think that it would be an overreach to apply Dominski beyond the limits of its case, holding that the definition of conspicuousness applies to a UCC contract. And part of the reason I say that is I think there are a lot of contracts that include indemnification provisions that would be quite surprised if they were subject to UCC drafting requirements.
Let me further that, because that's an area of real concern for me. When I looked at Dominski, I mean, it didn't say that this is a UCC transaction. It referenced like exculpatory contracts, which are strictly construed. I'm paraphrasing now, paragraph 28. We're going to strictly construe indemnity contracts, and we're going to hold that the conspicuousness standards that are set forth in Chapter 401 are going to apply here.
Yeah.
That's the way I read that holding.
Yeah, I think you have to limit it, though, to UCC contracts. I don't think you would want to be in a position where you're requiring, for instance, merger and acquisition agreements to adhere to the UCC 401-201 definition?
Perhaps, and so that's why I wanted to explore that. Dominski didn't limit it. I mean, do you believe that the language in the holding that I read limited it?
I don't think the language itself did, but I think that the way Dominski needs to be read is to limit it to the facts of that case.
Otherwise, what about my question to your opposing counsel regarding exculpatory contracts? Are there any cases where we struck down exculpatory contracts? And, of course, we do that with some frequency. That was dependent on whether or not it was a contract for goods or services?
We really didn't look at that in this case, and I can't speak specifically to that, but I will say most of those exculpatory contract cases do deal with consumers. And I think it does make sense to have somewhat of a different standard when you're dealing with commercial business entities. And, you know, we sort of, this case, in the briefing, there's a lot of talk about technical readings of contracts and who's going to be best positioned to actually interpret contracts and do you need magic language and things like that. And I think that between business entities, they should be able to rely on, you know, the common understanding of phrases and not be beholden to requirements that only a lawyer would really know.
Would your position be different if this were a consumer rather than a business entity?
I think the arguments would be different if this was a consumer versus a business entity. You know, I think the case law looks differently. I mean, you look at Ohio, and they talk about whether you narrowly construe or broadly construe an indemnification agreement. It depends on the audience. I also
Would your arguments regarding ambiguity be different if this were a consumer rather than a business?
I don't think the ambiguity arguments would change, and specifically, I think that the definition of the guarantee on whatever the page is, appendix page 26 of our appendix, makes it clear what we're not guaranteeing. We're not guaranteeing your fire suppression system won't malfunction. I think this contract is clear in trying to limit the liability that Syntus has for doing this narrow scope of work. I also think, even if you're going to apply UCC 401-201, it's not an objective test. It's a subjective test. The definition itself says you look to who the audience is, who is the contract meant to be enforced against, and that's the type of person. Would that type of person, that specific person, have noticed the indemnity provision or, you know, the exculpatory clause provision? So I think even the UCC anticipates that it's different depending on the audience. So here I think you do look at it slightly differently because it's commercial business entities. And I see that my light is almost on, so I'll sum up. In conclusion, we ask that this court affirms the Court of Appeals on two separate grounds. One, this clause is enforceable under Wisconsin law because it clearly states that that the risk of a fire suppression system malfunction is allocated to Becker, and two, and in doing so, hopefully give some clarity to the Spivey test, and two, find that the Ohio choice of law provision is enforceable here because these types of agreements are not contrary to public policy, and in so doing, maybe give some additional guidance to trial courts who are trying to follow Bush. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd like to begin by addressing some of the closing comments.
Before you do, Mr. Silver, would you agree that absent the language from the first page of the contract, that paragraph 10, the language there, is sufficient to cover Cintas' own negligence?
That's a good question. Under the terms of the hypothetical, how about, I'll say that it can't, I won't say that it's an entirely unreasonable argument, but I think it can be reasonably argued that it does not stand for the proposition that Becker protects Cintas for Cintas negligence.
Okay. To the extent that you take that position, then tell me what would paragraph 10 cover, if not Cintas' own negligence?
It would cover liability that Cintas may have because of something Becker did or something that Becker was responsible for. So if Cintas gets sued and it turns out that the reason somebody's pointing the finger at Cintas is because of something that Becker should have done but didn't do, then Cintas could invoke the provision and thereunder acquire some rights. There's an important point here, which is that this indemnity provision doesn't talk about negligence. It talks about any conduct. And I would maintain that this basically functions as an exculpatory provision. It would arguably, if you take Cintas's position seriously, it would arguably protect Cintas even from its own intentional conduct because there's nothing in the language that would suggest to the contrary. Again, this is if you buy Cintas's argument, and I don't buy it. I'd also like to go back to the point that there is a guarantee here. It's on the first page. I have seen nothing in this contract that would remove the effect of that guarantee. Interestingly, the claims provision at the end of the contract actually goes out of its way to say the seller shall not be liable for any claim in excess of the purchase price and that the seller doesn't have any obligation to be liable for claims respecting violation of any statute, rule, regulation, et cetera. This is actually under the limited liability provision.
I'm not quite sure I followed you on the comment that you made almost in passing. I'm not sure I followed you in the comment you made almost in passing about them being able to seek indemnification in regard to their own intentional tort. Is that what you said?
If you read, yes, that's what I said. If you take their position seriously and literally, Becker would be required under this indemnity provision to indemnify Cintas even for Cintas's own intentional conduct, causing intended to cause a loss, let's say.
Under paragraph 10?
Under paragraph 10, because it in their construction, because they maintain that this provision requires that Becker indemnify Cintas. Not with respect to negligence, doesn't say anything about negligence, with respect to everything. My time is almost up, and I do want to drive this point home. This limited liability provision, it goes out of its way to say that that Cintas does not warrant the service provided is in compliance with any statute, rule, or code. That's exactly contradicted by the very first page of the document, which says that the work will be performed in accordance with NFPA and state and city codes. This is just an example of why the document is rife with these internal contradictions, why it requires lawyers to try to sort it all out, and why there needs to be a bright line rule that prevents out-of-state corporations in particular from basically taking advantage of consumers in Wisconsin. And I don't care if it's just a little old lady who's a homeowner or if it's a big corporation. It doesn't make sense to try to carve out specific rules as to whether conspicuousness applies to products, services, sole proprietorships, little LLCs, standard corporations, limited partnerships. There should be a single rule that applies to all. I think that rule is set forth in Dominski. And I think that rule in Dominski and Wisconsin public policy prevents a party from basically promising to guarantee the work performed under a warranty, the net effect of which is the promise is that if something goes wrong, you're going to pay for it. And that's exactly what Cintas is attempting to do in this case. I see I'm pretty much out of time. Thank you, Your Honors. Mm-hmm.
Thank you both for very interesting arguments. We are going to break for lunch now, and we'll be back at 1:30 for our third case of the day. Justice Kelly will be joining the students and anybody else who would like to stay momentarily. We are adjourned.